And funny we should be talking about snowpack, because our inland valleys can generally be dry places. Take Medford, for example. Right smack in the middle of the region served by this radio station and the recipient of fewer than 20 inches of precipitation in a year. Despite that, our region is crisscrossed with rivers and smaller streams, and they could be some truly fascinating places. Our guests can attest to that. Tim Palmer's fascination with the region's rivers led him to write a book, The Field Guide to California Rivers, followed by a more recent Field Guide to Oregon Rivers. Somewhere in there, Tim snuck in a book about California glaciers. He's got several others as well. Tim speaks at the Criterion Theater in Medford on Wednesday, the latest in a series of lectures offered by the Oregon Wildlife Foundation. Tim Palmer visits here again today. Tim, welcome back to The Exchange.
Hi there, Jeffrey. I'm excited to be here with you.
Always good to have you. Tell us about you and what got your travels across the landscape, generally in search of water and all of its forms, going.
Well, you know, I guess I just love rivers. You know, I grew up with them in Pennsylvania. I moved to the West and to Oregon, and there's no better place for a rivers aficionado than here. And, you know, I've wondered really just what that nugget of interest and attachment and passion was, and I guess it boils down to rivers are simply the lifelines. These are the ribbons of life across the landscape that wildlife and people depend upon so completely.
Do you find the rivers a little more fascinating in the West because the West does tend to be somewhat drier and the landscape's more rugged, that sort of thing?
Well, you know, they're fascinating everywhere, really. And Oregon is just an amazing place because of our diversity. You know, you talked about how dry it is in the valley at Medford, but yet we have rivers, and that's because we have these mountain ranges, the Coast Range and the Cascades, that rake off the rainfall and snowfall when we get it, and supply these rivers. So, you know, so we have the coastal streams, we have the Cascade Mountain streams, we have desert streams in the east. We have the Snake River, which is this powerhouse that provides the biggest whitewater in the West next to the Grand Canyon. The Willamette's the longest river entirely in Oregon. It's kind of the Mississippi of Oregon, and the Huck Finn River, where you can just get on it in a canoe and go for weeks down to the Columbia. So we have all this amazing variety here in Oregon, which does make our place so utterly amazing.
And is there anything like that variety in the East Coast? It doesn't seem that there's that much variety in landscape.
You know, not so much. I mean, they've got their own good things, you know, but as far as variety, no. I mean, here we can drive 1 hour and be in a totally different kind of on a totally different kind of river, whereas in the East, it's not so much.
So I'm curious about the method of approach when you're preparing something like especially the Field Guide to California Rivers, as huge as California is geographically, Oregon for that matter too, was it the eighth largest state? But what do you do in the way of a field survey? How much time do you spend there? What do you look at? What do you focus on?
Yeah, good question. So how do I get my head around something so big? Well, for one thing, I've been doing this a long time. You know, I first came to Oregon in 1967 as a laborer for the National Park Service at Crater Lake, and I was fascinated then by the Upper Rogue. You know, I went to Union Creek, and you see the river there. It's amazing. And then I hitchhiked out to the coast, and I saw actually my first weekend on the job, a drift boater picked me up in Grants Pass and took me to Galice and said, come along with me for a while. So I jumped in the front of the drift boat and went down to Grave Creek. I had to get out there. And then I hiked the trail from there down for the weekend. So I go way back. So I'm drawing on some deep personal history. And then once I became a full-time writer 30 years ago, you know, with every book, my goal was simply to learn everything there was to learn about the place. And I do that by reading about it, by interviewing people, and in the case of the guidebooks especially, by going there. And so going there for the field guide to Oregon Rivers and my field guide to California Rivers was just a remarkable experience, because I had the excuse and actually the mandate to systematically explore the rivers of the state. And I did that by hiking. Yeah, I had obviously to drive there to begin with, but hiking, by boating, by fishing, canoeing, rafting. You know, it was just an incredible experience to see Oregon from this point of view.
Speaking of which, I mean, a place can look really different from inside a river than from the banks looking at the river, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you really want to get the full experience, you know, get in a boat and float down the river, a raft or a canoe or a kayak or a drift boat. And when you're on the water, it just becomes something altogether different. I mean, it's great just to be on the shore. I'm not knocking that at all. And I spend probably most of my time hiking along rivers. We've got great trails in Oregon along rivers. But by getting on the water, you really enter the realm of the river itself. And as you travel, you know, you're on this free, forget the fossil fuels, gravity is doing the work. You float downstream through Oregon by river. And if you're lucky enough to spend more than a day there on an overnight trip or a two-day trip or three-day or sometimes 2 weeks I can go in on rivers in Oregon, you really enter this other realm of river time. And with all the amazing events and sequences, you know, the sunrise to the sunset and the morning calm followed by the afternoon winds and the pull and riffle sequence over and over again, every night with that dome of stars overhead, there's nothing like it.
Tim Palmer's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, has written The Field Guide to Oregon Rivers, The Field Guide to California Rivers, speaks in Medford Wednesday evening at 6:30 at the Criterion Ginger Rogers. Whoops, not called the Ginger Rogers anymore. The Criterion Theater. And you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Share river stories with us. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer and you in a minute 20. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Tim Palmer, a river lover from the word go. He has written lots of words himself about rivers in the region, including The Field Guide to Oregon Rivers, more recently The Field Guide to California Rivers, a bit before that, and a bunch of other books about rivers and natural forms in our region, often focused on water. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Maybe you got some stories you can share about your experiences with rivers in either side of the state line, and maybe some questions for Tim about his explorations of those rivers as well. 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. You had mentioned just before we hit the break about spending 2 weeks on a river. Have you spent that much time on, say, the Willamette, for example?
I have, Jeffrey, yes. The Willamette was the one. It's the longest trip I've taken in time in Oregon. And actually, the longest trip you can do on it doesn't start with the Willamette. It starts with the Mackenzie. If you don't want any dams or really big rapids, you can put it in at Leeburn Dam on the Mackenzie and boat wonderful Class 2 whitewater for 40 miles down to the Willamette, just north of Eugene, and then another 140 miles down the Willamette to Willamette Falls, but you definitely want to stop there.
Yeah.
It's the biggest waterfall in the West. It's the only waterfall that's bigger than Willamette Falls on the Willamette in the United States is Niagara. And almost nobody knows that. Almost nobody sees it because there's no real street that goes to it, even though it's right at the edge of Portland. But it's this giant waterfall that's dammed at its upper end, but still a waterfall for the most part. And you have to stop there.
Which raises some interesting questions because was it Blue Heron Paper, I guess, had the mill there for a long time, and several companies before that owned that mill. The paper mill has since shut down, I don't know, a good 5-10 years ago, I think. And so there's talk, at least, of making that potentially public property again, I understand. But it's been a bit of an effort, but certainly worth it if it gets to the point where people can actually get up a little more close to Willamette Falls than they've been able to for decades.
Yeah, it will be a phenomenal asset to Oregon and to the Portland urban area when that happens. I mean, I don't know if any of you have seen Great Falls of the Potomac just outside Washington, D.C., but it's going to be like that. It's going to be this incredible feature that If it were in Yellowstone National Park, people would be going there to see it. And it's right there in Portland. And, you know, so that will be a great day when that is opened up for the public to see and to get close to.
What is your vessel of choice when you're spending this much time on a river?
You know, I just love a canoe. I mean, you know, there's this thing about canoes. There's a whole culture of canoes, and sometimes it defies reason because they're a lot harder to paddle than a kayak, and they're far less forgiving than a raft. But, you know, just for grace and beauty of a boat, a canoe to me is the tops. And I love getting on a river where I can handle the water with the canoe, which means not enormous white water, but not enormous water, white water, and just loading that boat and going. The John Day is another one of these great long rivers that you can do in Oregon in a canoe, or for most people would rather take a raft, but it's canoeable. But you just get in the boat and you go day after day and see the scenery change and just check out everything that's there. And it's a wonderful experience. I love canoeing. You know, I love the whitewater in the canoe too, but I also love rafting for bigger rivers, bigger whitewater. You know, a raft with my rowing frame or a crew of paddlers is also a great way to go.
Wow, this is sounding fun. We have some calls for you already. No big surprise here. Let's go first to Mark in Redding. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer.
Good morning. Yes, one can see the Oregon, the Willamette Falls in Oregon City if one takes the train.
Yes, I've noticed that. The Amtrak trains run right past that area.
Yeah, good point.
It's parked between the main line and the falls, but most days anymore you can actually see the falls.
Have you taken that trip several times, Mark?
Multiple occasions.
Mm-hmm. And have you had a chance to stop, though, and actually, like, walk to the falls, that kind of thing?
No, I've never done that, but I know that there are people that fish near the base of the falls, and then there are people that fish for eels right on the falls.
All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. So I didn't stop to think, Tim, though, your comparison of that to Niagara. So it's the second largest volume of water tumbling down a fall?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, and from the top, you can see it actually from 99 going south above. It kind of looks like a dam from the top because it is cemented in. But from the bottom, you really don't see that low dam, and that's where it looks amazing. And you can see it from the train, but the way most people see it is by boating up from the mouth of the Clackamas. And, you know, in a motorboat or a canoe or a rowboat, you can go up toward the base of it.
I'm still trying to figure out how they got all that concrete in there.
Yeah, right.
That was a tricky thing. Let's go take another call from John in Veneta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about Tim Palmer. He's author of The Field Guide to Oregon Rivers and The Field Guide to California Rivers.
Good morning, Jeff. Good morning, Tim.
Hi.
I got just a pretty simple question. Have you done the wilderness stretch of the Illinois? And if you have, what was its flow at the time?
Yeah. The Illinois is one of the classic whitewater rivers of the West. And I did the trip at about 1,500 CFS, which is a wonderful flow. It's big and powerful, but not overbearing. And I rafted it with a crew of really competent boaters, which you want to be a part of. You want to be on that river with people who know what they're doing. And it was an absolutely splendid float. You know, we had no particular problems. There's a Class 5 rapid, the Green Wall, that's very challenging. It was a 3-day trip. The Illinois, very interestingly now, is the water quality of that river is now threatened by a big mine proposal upstream. There's a nickel mine proposed at the headwaters of Rough and Ready Creek, which runs into the Illinois. And so these incredible waters, which are also some of the finest coho spawning habitat in the Rogue Basin, they are threatened by this mine proposal that just really puts this incredible resource at risk.
Over the time that you've been, and you mentioned you've been writing about rivers for 30 years now. I mean, over that period of time, have you seen generally an improvement in rivers, a degradation in rivers? Are they generally about the same in quality from your?
Jeffrey, it's a totally mixed bag. You know, there's some dramatic successes, such as the Willamette. You know, which you used to not want to touch the Willamette. And was polluted with pulp mill waste and toxics and hazardous waste and sewage. And thanks to Tom McCall and Governor Robert Straub and others, The Willamette is a remarkable cleanup success story after the Clean Water Act of 1972 and some Oregon actions before that. There was a huge turnaround, so that the Willamette is now pretty darn nice. It's still not what it should be, and there's still toxic problems at the lower river. But it's a dramatic success. A few other rivers are that way, but while we manage to cope with the really egregious problems of untreated sewage waste and just gross dumping of industrial waste, we've not dealt effectively with a more ubiquitous and insidious kind of waste from big areas of land disturbance, such as farming and clear-cut logging. This is called polluted runoff. It's not a pipe that you can just say, there it is, fix it. It's a big area of land, and to fix those problems requires better management practices in our farming, our grazing, our logging. We've made headway there. There are a lot of farmers and some logging companies that are doing a far better job today because there has been attention placed on this problem, but still we have a long way to go. Polluted runoff is the key pollution we still have to face. And along with that, I might add, I mentioned the mining problem before. Mining waste is the number one problem of toxic pollution in America. And on rivers as remarkable as the Rogue and the Smith in California and the Illinois, we are still facing mining threats of open pit strip mines for nickel that would set us back just decades in our efforts to clean up the waters of Oregon.
Well, Tim Palmer is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about rivers. He is the author of The Field Guide to Oregon Rivers, The Field Guide to California Rivers, and many other books about waterways in our region, including the glaciers of California. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about rivers and their great attributes and some of the threats to them that we're getting to now. Join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So you can forgive a few people, Tim, if they're thinking, well, wait a minute. So, okay, mining is one thing, but wouldn't they have some requirements on them to not pollute the rivers?
Yeah. There are. We do have a Clean Water Act, fortunately, but unfortunately, a lot of problems slip through the cracks. We still have a mining law passed in 1872 that is the principal law governing mining on public lands in America. It needs to be upgraded. There have been efforts to do that for decades, but we've never really succeeded. So we're operating under a law that was passed back when miners were swinging axes and shovels instead of giant drag lines for strip mining. So the laws in that regard are antiquated and totally inadequate. We have other problems simply of enforcement. You know, you might have a law, but these are extremely remote areas. The public agencies responsible for administering those rules and regulations are often starved for funding, and they don't, you know, they might have one or two enforcement people for a huge area, so they only are able to get out there once or twice a year, and the rest of the time it's kind of honor system. And so even though we do have a good body of law relative to pollution and the quality of our water, there's still a lot of ways for problems to slip through the cracks.
Let us take another call. Here's Brent in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer. We're talking rivers.
Hi, thanks, Jeffrey. Yeah, I'm an avid lover of the Sacramento Delta area. I was wondering, I have two questions, actually, wondering if your guest has ever floated the stretch of the Sacramento that you start crisscrossing when you get down to Redding and Red Bluff area. I've always been fascinated by that stretch of river. And the second question is, I was wondering if he's aware of Congress people sort of nibbling away at the wild and scenic designations so that they can grab water from the northern part of the state of California and ship it to almond groves in, oh gosh, Kern County, I believe. And I'll take my answers off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Brent. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I've been talking maybe a little too much about Oregon here. California has an equally amazing estate of rivers, and the Sacramento is one of them. And Brent, I have canoed that section from Redding to Red Bluff. It is amazing. You know, this is the second largest river on the West Coast next to the Columbia. And the Redding to Red Bluff section is the one piece that kind of still shows you, gives you a hint of what it once was before the dams, before the levees, before farming went right up to the banks, which is what it does below on downstream further. So that's an amazing section of river and a beautiful cottonwood corridor, just rich in wildlife. It's fast-moving water, but not real rapid or dangerous, and it's cold and clear in the summer, and there's great trout fishing, and so it's just a wonderful resource. I agree with you on that. The other part of the question, are there efforts to whittle away at our protected estate of rivers, and in particular so that the Southern California water users, especially Big Ag in the South, can get to them? Yes, there are. There's a very troubling bill that has passed the House twice, the U.S. House twice, to actually rescind a part of the Merced River. That's the River of Yosemite, the one that you see going over the big waterfalls like Nevada and Vernal. The Merced downstream of Yosemite is a national wild and scenic river, which means it's to be protected against dams and other intrusions. And there's a bill that's passed the House twice to take part of that out so that the Merced Irrigation District can raise the level of a dam downstream. And they wouldn't be raising it much, but still, it would be a very dangerous precedent to start whittling. It'd be like taking a part of Yosemite out of the national park because someone wants to build a shopping mall. And, of course, what we fear, and groups like Friends of the River in California fear, is that if they start chipping away there, then it will be much easier to say, well, okay, you know, we once had this proposal for Dos Rios Dam on the Middle Fork of the Eel to ship lots of water to the south, and, you know, we'll just kind of tune that one up again and take it for a spin. And, of course, the drought is severe in California. There'll be growing political pressure to solve the problems of water. So I think the answer is yes, our northern rivers could be at risk if we are not eternally vigilant about protecting them and coming up with actually better and more economic ways of providing that water where it's needed.
Is it hard sometimes to follow where water flows in California in particular, because there's been so much in the way of efforts to make sure that there is water for agriculture in the Central Valley? And you've got water crisscrossing the Delta. You've got, for example, you got Trinity River water ending up in the Sacramento system when the bulk of the Trinity water ends up in the Klamath system, so forth.
Yeah. It's a totally Rube Goldberg kind of scheme down there. You know, the South Yuba is diverted into the Bear, and then that's diverted into the North Fork of the American, and that's dammed up and shipped south. And the Trinity, right close to home, you know, the Trinity is the largest tributary to the Klamath. And for years after in the early 60s, when dams were built on the upper Trinity, 90% of the flow of that lifeline of the Klamath and its fishery was piped south for big agriculture in the southern Central Valley of California. Fortunately, the Central Valley Improvement Act of 1992 changed that, and we got back about 30% of that water. We're still missing a lot. A lot of the Trinity is still diverted to the south. And even with that reform, there are groups like Westlands Irrigation District that are still trying to rescind that reform to get back the whole 90% they once had. So it's it's an endless kind of struggle here. And, so it just demands endless attention and, as I said, vigilance to see that our rivers are protected.
You're getting a fair number of emails here. Jay in Walterville points out there's a natural history of the Sierra Nevada out from Berkeley Press. It applies to the Cascades also. He says it's a great overall field and science guide to flora, fauna, and geology. So a plug for another book. But then he says, I'm going to John Day in early April. You were just talking about floating the John Day River and being able to spend a fair amount of time. I'm a little surprised, I guess, not having a lot of experience with Eastern Oregon, that you can spend that much time on a river out.
The John Day, I hope I don't sound like a broken record with every river being amazing, but they are. The John Day, you can take a trip of 250 miles on the John Day. It's the longest river trip you can do in the West, in the Northwest without a dam. And starting on the North Fork of the John Day, which is larger than the main stem where they meet, the whole way down to the backwaters of the Dalles Dam on the Columbia. And, you know, it's this beautiful river that starts in the green forests of the Blue Mountains and then breaks through into the ponderous pine savanna and then into these wonderfully remote, just resoundingly wild canyons of basalt rock as the river cuts through the Columbia Plateau. So the John Day, yes, it's just a wonderful resource that we have here in the state. And, you know, it flows with snow melt, so you have to be there in April or May. By June, it starts dropping a little too low for most rafts. But if you go in the springtime, it's a great place.
All right, many more rivers to talk about, and not a great deal of time in which to do it, but we'll come back and talk more with Tim Palmer about the rivers of Oregon, the rivers of California, and the rivers you want to talk about in that whole realm. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange by phone or by email. We'll give the number again when we come back from the break. Back with Tim Palmer and you on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking to Tim Palmer about rivers today. Tim Palmer knows and loves rivers, and spends a lot of time on them. He'll be speaking about them to the Oregon Wildlife Foundation Lecture Series Wednesday at 6:30 at the Criterion Theater in Medford. He's the author of The Field Guide to California Rivers, The Field Guide to Oregon Rivers, and many more books about rivers and even glaciers. And you can join him here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about bodies of water in motion in our region. 800-838-3760 to ask questions or make comments. Or you can send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So 2 weeks on the John Day River. You mentioned 250 miles you can spend on that river in a free float without any dams. No portaging at all? You don't have to go around any falls or rapids or anything?
You know, there's one rapid, Jeffrey, at a place called Clarino, and it's easily rafted. Most canoeists like to carry around that, which is what I did. And other than that, you know, there's fast water, so you have to be experienced and know what you're doing, but it's all doable in a canoe at the lower flow levels.
I was just looking at some pictures of you in canoes, and it looks like you have a pretty well-loaded boat there. When you're making a trip that's that long on the John Day, for example, how much stuff do you take in the boat? How much do you have that you're available for reprovisioning along the way, that sort of thing?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of like a backpacking trip. I mean, I have waterproof bags that hold all the food I need and a small camp stove and, of course, my tent and sleeping gear and those kind of things. And so it's easier than backpacking, so I take a little more than that. But, you know, a few waterproof bags and a cooler for food and, you know, it's not that much stuff. It's like four loads I stick in the boat and I tie it down real tightly and away you go. And on the raft trips, of course, you can take more stuff and sometimes there, you know, you go longer too. My wife and I have done a long Rogue River trip, which was wonderful from, at the time, Savage Rapids Dam, which I'm happy to say is now gone. But we put in there and went the whole way to the ocean. We did a 100-mile trip on the Deschutes River, which is another one of the really popular Oregon rivers. On those trips, there's bigger water, so we took the raft, and then it's really easy to take whatever gear you want.
You could do the Rogue River now all the way from Lost Creek Dam to the ocean, couldn't you?
That's right. That's right. And that's high on my list, Jeffrey. I've not gotten back since Savage Rapids and Gold Hill and Gold Ray Dam came out in 2008, 2009, and 2010. And you know, we went from about 110 miles of free-flowing river to 157. And you know, it's become one of the just great long free-flowing sections of river in the West. And amazing, in Ashland, your listeners there will know, this past year was the first time in memory that a healthy, abundant, robust run of Chinook salmon returned to the city of Ashland on Bear Creek, because a few had been able to make it before, but most were stopped by the complications imposed by those three dams. We got rid of those. The salmon are coming back. It's one of the great restoration stories of Oregon and of the West, and there are others too. You know, we've done a great job. We're doing a great job at river restoration here in Oregon on the Rogue and elsewhere.
You mentioned threats to some streams, though, including to the Illinois and a potential mining action there. We have an email here from Barbara in Grants Pass, and I'm pretty sure which Barbara this is. She says, please ask Tim to tell us about his recent float down the North Fork Smith River.
Yeah, the Smith is in main stem is in California. It's the most pristine river left in the entire state of California. It's the only major undammed river. The North Fork of the Smith starts in Oregon. The Calmeopsis Wilderness flows south into California. The North Fork is the wildest fork of the Smith. It's the purest, the cleanest. And so 2 weeks ago, when the water was up with a few friends and Grant Warshkel, who's the head of the Smith River Alliance, my wife Ann and I were able to raft down the North Fork through this incredible wilderness, through these big rapids of utterly crystal clear water. And it's an experience really unlike any other. And this, too, is one of these rivers that's threatened by the three nickel mines. This one would be at the head of Baldface Creek, which is one of the finest tributaries to the North Fork of the Smith. So with all the waste from that mine would trickle down into Baldface, the North Fork Smith, the Smith River. It's one of the few salmon strongholds left on the West Coast. It's the water supply of Crescent City and Gaski and Hiuchi. Just tremendous values at risk because of that mining threat in a mine owned by that would be owned by a foreign corporation.
And there's no dam anywhere in the Smith River, is that right?
No, none. It's the only major river in California you can say that about, you know. And in Oregon, we have several major undammed rivers, but most of our rivers are dammed as well. You know, California has 1,400 large dams. We have 1,100. Most of our rivers have a dam somewhere or other along them, but the Smith does not.
Wow, that's a large number of dams. I never got that number before. California, 1,400 large dams, 1,100 in Oregon. Let us take another call. Here's Jamie in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Tim Palmer.
Yes, good morning, Jeffrey. Good morning, Tim.
Howdy.
Mr. Palmer, first of all, a comment. I would just like to compliment you on the tone and the manner of your speaking. It just seems to impart, to me anyway, the grandeur and the awe which nature has to provide when it comes to water in all its forms. And my question is going to be, it's a little bit of a sidebar. I know,
Jamie, you've made my day so far.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll keep going then.
Right.
I wanted to ask you to compare and contrast over your decades of observing the glaciers that seem to be receding due to global climate change. Could you, like, make some comments towards that?
Yeah, I'd love to. One of my recent books, as Jeffrey pointed out, is called California Glaciers. And this book was done because the glaciers are disappearing very rapidly owing to global warming. And in 1910, I took the opportunity to spend a summer glacier climbing and photographing these places because it's really the last chance to see them as they are. It's as if they were going to tear down Independence Hall next year and you want to go to Philadelphia to take a picture of it before it's gone. And so I spent a whole summer crawling around these glaciers, photographing this incredible, stark, sublime beauty of these natural features that are melting away as we speak, especially the last few dry years. They're receding extremely rapidly. And so I did a whole book of photos on that called California Glaciers. Oregon, of course, has glaciers too. We have bigger glaciers on our Cascade Peaks. They too are receding very rapidly. So the glaciers of Mount Hood are still very significant and awe-inspiring, but they're receding. You know, it's take a good look right now because they're never going to look the same again.
In fact, there's talk about Glacier National Park in Montana not having any actual glaciers by the middle of the century. Is that the general trend?
It's exactly, yes. Yeah, Glacier National Parks are disappearing very quickly. And this, of course, is all because of global warming. And this is only the most visible evidence of that problem. But glaciers probably are the most visible. But But the more insidious and troublesome problems, of course, are hotter temperatures, drier summers, bigger flood events, encroachment of exotic species that thrive in the warmer climate and the altered flows, rising sea level. This whole suite of problems is just a juggernaut that we're facing here in the future. We've simply got to do everything we can to stop that problem, which is combat the cause of global warming, which is fundamentally our burning of fossil fuels and our clear-cutting of forests. But we also have to recognize that a lot of what has been started will inevitably continue, and the climate is going to get warmer. We are going to have lower summer flows, bigger floods. And so for our rivers, we've got to build in more resilience to these natural systems. We can do that by actually doing what river conservationists have been working to do for the last 50 years, only just doing it faster, harder, and better. And that's things like effective floodplain zoning, by restricting diversions of water so that they don't get too low in the low flow seasons, by connecting areas of habitat with riparian connecting corridors so wildlife have a way of moving back and forth as the climate changes. Riparian buffers, we're doing a lot of that in the Rogue River because the Rogue is way too warm. The sewage waste is a problem there. There's a program to spend $8 million planting trees along the Rogue River. That is a good thing because we'll get shade back on those riverbanks and cool the water down. We need to do more and more of those kind of things in the face of this enormous, what can seem to be an overwhelming problem of climate change.
Tim, is there a single river you know better than any other, and have you noticed changes just in that river over recent years?
Well, you know, I live right near the Elk River here in southwestern Oregon.
Near Port Orford?
That's right. Yeah, I live in Port Orford. And, the Elk is another wonderful river. And as far as changes in recent years, they're not a lot, but that's because we've done a good job of protecting it. There's a local guy named Jim Rogers who was a forester turned conservationist. And Jim and Jerry Becker of the Land Trust here and others were able to protect open space along the river. We were able to get two sizable wilderness areas designated to build in that resilience I'm talking about, so that while neighboring basins like the Sixes or the Pistol or other parts, the lower Chetco and much of the Umpqua and many parts of Oregon have been clear cut almost entirely in the Coast Range. Only 1 to 5% of the old growth forest remains in the Coast Range clear cut. The Elk remains in kind of the way it always was. So the changes there have been much less. But yes, big changes elsewhere. You know, our salmon runs are in trouble. The water quality remains a big issue because of the polluted runoff problems I mentioned. I have seen changes even over the relatively short time I've been here.
We have an email here from David in Happy Camp. He says, here in Happy Camp, we have the new 49ers lawsuit to get dredging again. Suction dredging, he's referring to. Meanwhile, there's little enforcement of the Clean Water Act now that this issue's in court. I think if the miners are doing it again, like on Sucker Creek, it's just going to backfire on them, and we will get the 1872 mining law changed. We need to change it on the federal level, right? Is what Tim in Happy Camp is, David in Happy Camp is asking.
Yes, I think you're right, David. Well, in many respects, we do need to change the federal law. We do need to have better enforcement. That temporary ban on suction dredge mining should continue in California.
That's a state thing, though.
That's a state thing. And, of course, when they did that, a lot of those miners simply came to Oregon and started mining on the Rogue. And so then it forced us to upgrade our law, which was done 2 years ago. It was upgraded, but not enough. And I don't know if many of you know, suction dredge gold mining is, it's wonderful to be able to mine gold, and at a small scale, this is no problem. But, once the suction dredgers get to be bigger and there get to be too many of them, it stirs up the riverbed, it disturbs the spawning gravels and the invertebrate life that are the base of the food chain, and so it presents a lot of problems. And so we do need to come to better grips with that issue.
I wanted to ask some superlatives again. I know I asked this last time I talked to you, but is there a most dangerous, is there a scariest river you've been on in either Oregon or California?
Oh, you know, gosh, Jeffrey, I don't think of them that way. scary. You know, the...
Have you had some close calls, hairy times, Tippecanoes, things like that?
Yeah, I have here and there, mainly back in the earlier days of my boating experience, you know, when I didn't know enough to take the kind of precautions I should. You know, I had a couple of long swims. It's exciting, but I don't really think of it as scary. Last summer, Ann and I boated Hell's Canyon of the Snake River. There are two big rapids there, Wild Sheep and Granite. And I've done it only once before, which was in 1988. And as I dropped into Wild Sheep, it's this enormous flow. It's 17,000 cubic feet per second, which, if you're thinking rivers, the Rogue averages about 5. So this is a big flow in a rocky channel, and you have to pull hard to the right. And I didn't pull hard to the right enough. And this huge wave came and nearly flipped the boat over. But Anne is a very experienced rafter also, and she was in the front and high-sided. That's you throw your weight on the side of the boat that's rising up because the wave is pushing it that way. Mm-hmm. And her weight pulled the boat back down, and we made it through without flipping.
Well, I'm glad to still have you with us because there's so much you can still teach us about rivers in Oregon and California. Tim Palmer will speak at the Criterion Wednesday evening at 6:30, one of the lecture series from the Oregon Wildlife Foundation. He's been our guest today on the Jefferson Exchange. Tim, always good to talk to you.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I'd love to see folks on Wednesday night, and it's been a real pleasure to be on your show.